pants and it was sticking straight out.
Forks do that sometimes, Grandma said. I collected my clothes and Mooner and headed for home. If I was in better shape, I would have driven over to the snake pit, but that was going to have to wait for another day.
So, tell me again why everyone is looking for this Eddie DeChooch guy, Mooner said.
I'm looking for him because he failed to appear for a court date, and the police are looking for him because they think he might be involved in a murder.
And he thinks I've got something that's his.
Yeah. I watched Mooner as I drove, wondering if something was shaking loose in his head, wondering if a piece of important information would float to the surface.
So, what do you think? Mooner said. Do you think Samantha can do all that magic stuff if she doesn't twitch her nose?
No, I said. I think she has to twitch her nose. Mooner gave this serious consideration.
That's what I think, too.
It was Monday morning, and I felt like I'd been run over by a truck. A scab had formed on my knee, and my nose ached. I dragged myself out of bed and limped into the bathroom. Eek! I had two black eyes. One was considerably blacker than the other. I got into the shower and stood there for what might have been a couple hours. When I staggered out, my nose felt better, but my eyes looked worse. Mental note, 2 hours in a hot shower, not good in early stages of black eye. I blasted my hair with the dryer and pulled it back into a ponytail. I dressed in my usual uniform of jeans and stretchy t-shirt and went out to the kitchen in search of breakfast. Ever since Valerie showed up, my mother had been too distracted to send me home with a traditional food bag, so there was no pineapple upside-down cake in my refrigerator. I poured a glass of orange juice and dropped a slice of bread in the toaster. It was quiet in my apartment. Peaceful. Nice. Too nice. Too peaceful. I stepped out of the kitchen and looked around. Everything seemed to be in order, except for the rumpled quilt and pillow on the couch. Oh, shit. There was no Mooner. Damn, damn, damn. I ran to the door. It was closed and locked. The security chain was hanging loose, not securing the door. I opened the door and looked out. No one in the hall. I looked out the living room window, down at the parking lot. No Mooner. No suspicious characters or cars. I called Mooner's house. No answer. I scribbled a note to Mooner that I'd be back and he should wait for me. He could wait in the hall, or he could break into my apartment. Hell, everybody breaks into my apartment. I taped the note to my front door and took off. First stop was Mooner's house. Two roommates, no Mooner. Second stop, Dougie's house. No luck there. I cruised by the social club, Eddie's house, and Ziggy's house. I went back to my apartment. No sign of Mooner. I called Morelli. He's gone, I said. He was gone when I got up this morning.
Is that bad?
Yes, it's bad.
I'll keep my eyes open.
There haven't been any,
Bodies washed up on the shore, bodies found in dumpsters, dismembered limbs stuffed into the overnight drop at the video store. No, it's been slow. None of those.
I hung up and called Ranger. Help, I said.
Heard you got trashed by some old lady last night, Ranger said. We've got to get you some self-defense lessons, babe. Not good for the image to get trashed by an old lady.
I have bigger problems than that. I was babysitting Mooner, and he disappeared.
Maybe he just split.
Maybe he didn't.
He driving a car?
His car's still in my lot. Ranger let the silence lie there for a beat.
I'll ask around and get back to you.
I called my mother. You haven't seen Mooner, have you? I asked.
What? She yelled. What did you say?
I could hear Angie and Mary Alice running around in the background. They were screaming at each other, and it sounded like they were banging on pots. What's going on? I shouted into the phone.
Your sister's gone off on a job interview, and the girls are having a parade.
It sounds more like they're having World War III. Has Mooner been around this morning?
No, I haven't seen him since last night. He's a little strange, isn't he? Are you sure he's not on drugs?
I left the note to Mooner taped to my front door, and I drove down to the office. Connie and Lula were sitting at Connie's desk, watching the door to Vinny's private lair. Connie made a gesture for me to be quiet.
Joyce is in there with Vinny,
she whispered.
They've been at it for 10 minutes now.
You should have been here in the beginning when Vinny was making sounds like a cow. Think Joyce must have been milking him, Lula said.
Some low-key grunting and moaning was going on beyond the closed door. The grunting stopped, and Lula and Connie leaned forward expectantly.
This is my favorite part, Lula said. This is where they get to the spanking, and Joyce barks like a dog.
I leaned forward with them, listening for the spanking, wanting Joyce to bark like a dog, feeling embarrassed but not able to walk away. I was firmly pulled back by my ponytail. Ranger had come in behind me and had me by the hair.
Glad to see you're hard at work looking for Mooner.
Shh! I want to hear Joyce bark like a dog!
Ranger had me flat against him, and I could feel the heat from his body seeping into mine.
Not sure that's worth waiting for, babe.
There was some slapping and some squealing, and then there was silence.
Well, that was fun, Lula said, but there's going to be a price for the entertainment. Joyce only goes in there when she wants something. And there's only one high bond case pending right now.
I looked at Connie. Eddie DeChooch? Vinny wouldn't give Eddie over to Joyce, would he?
Usually he only sinks that low when there are horses involved,
Connie said.
Yeah, equine sex is the dollar ticket, Lula said.
The door opened and Joyce flounced out.
I'll need the paperwork on DeChooch, she said.
I lunged at her, but Ranger still had hold of my hair, so I didn't get very far.
Vinny, I yelled, get out here!
The door to Vinny's inner office crashed closed, and there was the sound of the lock clicking into place. Lula and Connie glared at Joyce.
It's going to take a while to get the paperwork together, Connie said. Maybe days.
No problem, Joyce said. I'll be back.
She glanced over at me.
Nice eye. Very attractive.
I was going to have to do another bob on her lawn. Maybe I could sneak into her house somehow and do a bob on her bed. Ranger released my ponytail, but kept a hand on my neck. I tried to act calm, but his touch was humming through me all the way to my toes and points in between.
None of my contacts have seen anyone meeting Mooner's description, Ranger said. I thought we might discuss the subject with Dave Vincent.
Lula and Connie looked my way.
What's happened to Mooner?
Disappeared, I said. Just like Dougie. Chapter 8 Ranger was driving a black Mercedes that looked fresh off the showroom floor. Ranger's cars were always black, and always new, and always of questionable ownership. He had a pager and a cell phone clipped to his visor, and a police scanner under the dash. And I knew from past experience that there'd be a sawn-off shotgun and an assault weapon hidden somewhere in the car, and a semi-automatic clipped to his belt. Ranger is one of the few civilians in Trenton with a permit to carry concealed. He owns office buildings in Boston, has a daughter in Florida by a failed marriage, has worked worldwide as a mercenary, and has a moral code that isn't entirely in sync with our legal system. I have no idea who the heck he is, but I like him. The snake pit wasn't open for business, but there were cars parked in the small lot adjacent to the building, and the front door was ajar. Ranger parked next to a black BMW, and we went inside. A cleaning crew worked at polishing the bar and washing the floor. Three muscle-bound guys stood to one side, drinking coffee and talking. I assumed they were wrestlers going over the game plan. And I could see why Grandma left Bingo early to come to the snake pit. The possibility that one or more of the coffee drinkers could have his underwear ripped off in the mud held some appeal. Truth is, I think naked men are kind of strange-looking, what with their doodles and ding-dong hanging loose like they do. Nevertheless, there's the curiosity thing. I guess it's another one of those car crash experiences where you feel compelled to look, even if you know you'll be horrified. Two men were sitting at a table reviewing what looked like a spreadsheet. They were in their 50s with health club bodies, dressed in slacks and lightweight sweaters. They looked up when we entered. One of them acknowledged Ranger.
"Dave Vincent and his accountant," Ranger said to me. "Vincent is the one in the tan sweater, the one who nodded hello."
Perfect for the house in Princeton. Vincent stood and came over to us. He smiled when he saw my eye up close.
"You must be Stephanie Plum."
"I could have taken her out," I said. "She caught me by surprise. It was an accident."
"We're looking for Eddie DeChooch," Ranger said to Vincent. "Everyone is looking for DeChooch," Vincent said. "The guy's nutty." "We thought he might be keeping in touch with his business partners."
Dave Vincent shrugged.
"I haven't seen him. He's driving Mary Maggie's car."
Vincent showed some annoyance.
"I don't get involved with my employees' private lives. If Mary Maggie wants to loan Chooch a car, that's her business." "If she's hiding him, it becomes my business," Ranger said,
and we turned and left. "So," I said when we got to the car, "that seemed to go well." Ranger grinned at me.
"We'll see."
"Now what?"
"Benny and Ziggy, they'll be at the club."
"Oh, geez," Benny said when he came to the door. "Now what?"
Ziggy was a step behind him.
"We didn't do it."
"Do what?" I asked.
"Anything," Ziggy said. "We didn't do anything."
Ranger and I exchanged glances. "Where is he?" I asked Ziggy.
"Where's who?"
"Mooner."
"Is this a trick question?"
"No," I said. "It's a real question. Mooner is missing."
"Are you sure?"
Ranger and I gave them the silent stare down.
"Crap,"
Ziggy finally said. We left Benny and Ziggy with as much information as we had when we arrived, which meant we had nothing. Not to mention that I felt as if I just participated in an Abbott and Costello routine. "So, that seemed to go almost as well as the interview with Vincent," I said to Ranger. This got me another smile.
"Get in the car. We're visiting Mary Maggie next."
I gave him a salute and got into the car. I wasn't sure we were accomplishing anything, but it was a nice day to be riding around with Ranger. Riding with Ranger absolved me of responsibility. I was clearly the underling, and I was protected. No one would dare shoot at me when I was with Ranger. Or if they did shoot at me, I was pretty certain I wouldn't die. We drove in silence to Mary Maggie's condo building, parked one row over from her Porsche, and took the elevator to the 7th floor. Mary Maggie answered on the second knock. Her breath caught when she saw us, and she took a step backward. Ordinarily, this reaction might be construed as a sign of fear or guilt. In this case, it was the normal reaction women have when confronted with Ranger. To Mary Maggie's credit, it wasn't followed by flushing and stammering. Her attention traveled from Ranger to me.
"You again," she said.
I gave her a finger wave.
"What happened to your eye?"
"Parking dispute."
"Looks like you lost."
"Looks can be deceiving," I said. Not necessarily in this case, but sometimes.
"DeChooch was riding around town last night," Ranger said. "We thought you might have seen him."
"Nope."
"He was driving your car, and he was involved in an accident. Hit and run."
It was clear from the expression on Mary Maggie's face that this was the first she'd heard of the accident.
"It's his eyes. He shouldn't be driving at night," she said.
No shit. not to mention his mind, which should be keeping him off the road altogether. The man was a lunatic.
Was anyone hurt? Mary Maggie asked.
Ranger shook his head.
You'll call us if you see him, right?
I said.
Sure,
Mary Maggie said. She's not going to call us, I said to Ranger when we were in the elevator. Ranger just looked at me.
What?
I asked.
Patience.
The elevator doors opened to the underground garage, and I jumped out.
Patience? Mooner and Dougie are missing, and I've got Joyce Barnhart breathing down my neck. We ride around and talk to people, but we don't learn anything, and nothing happens, and no one even seems to be worried.
We're leaving messages, applying pressure. You apply pressure in the right spot, and things start to break down.
Hmm, I said, still not feeling like we'd accomplished a lot. Ranger unlocked his car with the remote.
Don't like the sound of that, hmm.
The pressure stuff sounds a little obscure.
We were alone in the dimly lit garage, just Ranger and me and two levels of cars and concrete. It was the perfect setting for a gangland murder or an attack by a deranged rapist.
Obscure,
Ranger repeated. He grabbed me by my jacket lapels, pulled me to him, and kissed me. His tongue touched mine, and I got a rush that was just a millimeter below climax. His hands slid inside my jacket and circled my waist. He was hard against me. And suddenly, nothing mattered but a Ranger-induced orgasm. I wanted one. Now, the hell with Eddie DeChooch. One of these days he'd drive himself into a bridge abutment, and that'd be the end of it.
Yes, but what about the wedding?
A small voice murmured from deep in my brain.
Shut up, I told the voice. I'll worry about it later. And what about your legs?
The voice asked.
Did you shave your legs this morning?
Cripes, I was barely able to breathe with needing this goddamn orgasm, and now I was supposed to worry about the hair on my legs? Where's the justice in this world? Why me? Why am I the one worrying about the hair on my legs? Why is it always the woman worrying about the freaking hair?
Earth to Steph, Ranger said.
If we do it now, does it count as a credit toward capturing DeChooch?
We aren't doing it now.
Why not?
We're in a parking garage, and by the time I get you out of the garage, she'll have changed your mind.
I narrowed my eyes at him.
So, what's the point here?
The point is that you can break down the person's defense system if you apply the right pressure.
Are you telling me this was just a demonstration? You got me into this state to prove a point?
His hands were still at my waist, holding me against him.
How serious is this state?
He asked. If it was any more serious, I'd spontaneously combust.
It's not that serious, I told him.
Liar.
How serious is your state?
Frighteningly serious.
You're complicating my life.
He opened the car door for me.
Get in. Ronald DeChooch is next on the list.
The front room to the paving company offices was empty when Ranger and I walked in. A young guy poked his head around a corner and asked what we wanted. We said we wanted to talk to Ronald. 30 seconds later, Ronald strolled in from somewhere in the back of the building.
I heard an old lady popped you in the eye, but I didn't realize she did such a good job, Ronald said to me. That's a first-class shiner.
Have you seen your uncle lately?
Ranger asked Ronald.
No, but I heard he was involved in the accident outside the funeral parlor. He shouldn't be driving at night.
The car he was driving belongs to Mary Maggie Mason, I said. Do you know her?
I seen her around.
He looked at Ranger.
Are you working this case, too?
Ranger gave a barely perceptible nod.
Good to know, Ronald said.
What was that? I asked Ranger when we got outside. Was that what I think it was? Was that hemorrhoid saying it made a difference with you on board, like now he was going to take the search seriously?
Let's take a look at Dougie's house, Ranger said.
Dougie's house hadn't changed since the last time I was there. No evidence of a new search. No evidence that Dougie or Mooner had passed through. Ranger and I went room by room. I filled Ranger in on the previous searches and the missing pot roast.
"Do you think it's significant that they took a pot roast?" I asked Ranger.
"One of life's mysteries," Ranger said.
We walked around back and snooped in Dougie's garage. The little yappy dog that lives next door to Dougie left his post on the Belsky's back porch and skipped around us, yipping and snapping at our pants legs.
"Think anyone would notice if I shot him?" Ranger asked.
"I think Mrs. Belsky would come after you with a meat cleaver."
"Have you talked to Mrs. Belsky about the people searching the house?"
I smacked myself in the forehead with the heel of my hand. Why hadn't I thought to talk to Mrs. Belsky?
"No."
The Belskys have lived in their row house forever. They're in their 60s now. Hard-working, sturdy Polish stock. Mr. Belsky is retired from Stuckey Tool and Die Company. Mrs. Belsky raised 7 children. And now they have Dougie for a neighbor. Lesser people would have been at war with Dougie. But the Belskys have accepted their fate as God's will and coexist. The Belsky's back door opened and Mrs. Belsky stuck her head out.
"Is Spotty bothering you?"
"Nope," I said. "Spotty is fine."
"He gets excited when he sees strangers,"
Mrs. Belsky said, coming across the yard to get Spotty.
"I understand there have been some strangers going through Dougie's house."
"There are always strangers in Dougie's house. Were you there when he held his Star Trek party?"
She shook her head.
"Such goings-on."
"How about lately, in the last couple days?"
Mrs. Belsky scooped Spotty up in her arms and held him close.
"Nothing like the Star Trek party."
I explained to Mrs. Belsky that someone had broken into Dougie's house.
"No," she said. "How terrible."
She gave a worried glance at Dougie's back door.
"Dougie and his friend Walter get a little wild sometimes, but they're really nice young people at heart. They're always nice to Spotty."
"Have you seen anyone suspicious hanging around the house?"
"There were 2 women," Mrs. Belsky said. "One was my age, maybe a little older, in her 60s. The other was a couple years younger. I was coming back from walking Spotty, and these women parked their car and let themselves into Dougie's house. They had a key. I assumed they were relatives. Do you suppose they were thieves?"
"Do you remember the car?"
"Not really. All cars look alike to me."
"Was it a white Cadillac? Was it a sports car?"
"No, it wasn't either of those. I would have remembered a white Cadillac or a fancy sports car."
"Anyone else?"
"An older man has been stopping by, thin, in his 70s. Now that I think about it, he might have been driving a white Cadillac. Dougie gets a lot of visitors. I don't always pay attention. I haven't noticed anyone looking suspicious, except for the women who had a key. I remember them because the older one looked at me, and there was something about her eyes. Her eyes were scary, angry, and crazy."
I thanked Mrs. Belsky and gave her my card. When I was alone in the car with Ranger, I got to thinking about the face Mooner saw in the window the night he got shot. It had seemed so improbable we hadn't given it a lot of attention. He hadn't been able to identify the face or even give it much detail, with the exception of the scary eyes. And now here was Mrs. Belsky telling me about a 60-something woman with scary eyes. There was also the woman who'd called Mooner and accused him of having something that belonged to her. Maybe this was the woman with the key. And how did she get a key? From Dougie, maybe.
"Now what?" I said to Ranger.
"Now we wait."
I've never been very good at waiting. I have another idea. How about if we use me as bait? How about if I call Mary Maggie and tell her I have the thing and I'm willing to trade it for Mooner, and then I ask her to pass it on to Eddie DeChooch?
You think Mary Maggie's the contact?
It's a shot in the dark.
Morelli called a half hour after Ranger dropped me off.
You're what?
Morelli yelled.
Bait.
Jesus.
It's a good idea, I said. We're gonna let people think I have whatever it is that they're after.
We?
Ranger and me.
Ranger.
I had a mental picture of Morelli clenching his teeth.
I don't want you working with Ranger.
It's my job. We're bounty hunters.
I don't want you doing that job, either.
Well, guess what? I'm not crazy about you being a cop.
At least my job is legitimate,
Morelli said.
My job is just as legitimate as yours.
Not when you work with Ranger,
Morelli said.
He's a nutcase, and I don't like the way he looks at you.
How does he look at me?
The same way I do.
I could feel myself hyperventilating. Breathe slow, I told myself. Don't panic. I got rid of Morelli, made myself a peanut butter and olive sandwich, and called my sister.
I'm worried about this marriage thing, I said. If you couldn't stay married, what are my chances?
Men don't think right, Valerie said. I did everything I was supposed to do, and it was wrong. How can that be?
Do you still love him?
I don't think so. Mostly I'd like to punch him in the face.
Okay, I said. I have to go now. And I hung up.
Next, I paged through the phone book, but there was no Mary Maggie Mason listed. No surprise there. I called Connie and asked her to get me the number. Connie had sources for unlisted phones.
While you're on the line, I've got a quickie for you,
Connie said.
Melvin Baylor. He didn't show up for court this morning.
Melvin Baylor lives two blocks from my parents. He's a perfectly nice 40-year-old guy who got taken to the cleaners in a divorce settlement that stripped him of everything but his underwear. To add insult to injury, 2 weeks after the settlement, his ex-wife Lois announced her engagement to their unemployed next-door neighbor. Last week, the ex and the neighbor got married. The neighbor is still unemployed, but now driving a new BMW and watching his game shows on a big-screen TV. Melvin, meanwhile, lives in a one-room apartment over Virgil Selig's garage and drives a 10-year-old brown Nova. On the night of his ex's wedding, Melvin gulped down his usual dinner of cold cereal and skim milk, and in profound depression drove his sputtering Nova to Casey's bar. Not being any kind of a drinker, Melvin got properly snockered after two martinis. He then got into his wreck of a car and for the first time in his life showed some backbone by crashing his ex-wife's wedding reception and relieving himself on the cake in front of 200 people. He was roundly applauded by every man in the room. Lois's mother, having paid $85 for the three-tiered extravaganza, had Melvin arrested for indecent exposure, lewd conduct, trespass on a private party, and destruction of private property.
I'll be right there, I said. Have the paperwork ready for me, and I'll get Mason's number when I come in.
I grabbed my bag and yelled to Rex that I wouldn't be gone long. I ran down the hall, down the stairs, and slammed into Joyce in the lobby.
I heard from people that you've been going all over this morning asking about DeChooch, Joyce said. DeChooch is mine now, so back off.
Sure.
And I want the file.
I lost it.
Bitch, Joyce said.
Snot.
Fat ass.
Douchebag.
Joyce whirled around and stormed out of the building. Next time my mother had chicken, I was going to wish on the wishbone that Joyce got herpes. The office was quiet when I got there. Vinny's door was closed. Lula was asleep on the couch. Connie had Mary Maggie's phone number and Melvin's permission to capture paper ready.
There's no answer at his house, Connie said, and he called in sick from work. He's probably at home hiding under the bed, hoping it's all a bad dream.
I tucked the permission to capture into my bag and used Connie's phone to call Mary Maggie.
I've decided I want to make a deal with Eddie, I said to Mason when she answered. Trouble is, I don't know how to get in touch with him. I thought since he's using your car, he might call you or something, let you know the car's okay.
What's the deal?
I have something Eddie's looking for.
and I want to trade Mooner for it.
Mooner?
Eddie will understand.
Okay, Mason said. If he calls in, I'll pass it on, but there's no guarantee I'll be talking to him.
Sure, I said. Just in case. Lula opened one eye.
Uh-oh, are you telling fibs again?
I'm bait, I said.
No kidding.
What is this thing Chooch is looking for?
Connie wanted to know.
I don't know, I said. That's part of the problem.
Usually people move out of the burg when they get divorced. Melvin was one of the exceptions. I think at the time of his divorce he was simply too exhausted and downtrodden to conduct any kind of a search for a place to stay. I parked in front of Selig's house and walked around back to the garage. It was a ramshackle two-car garage with a second-story, one-man, one-room ramshackle apartment. I climbed the stairs to the apartment and knocked. I listened at the door. Nothing. I banged on the door some more, put my ear to the scarred wood, and listened again. Someone was moving around in there.
"Hey, Melvin!" I yelled. "Open up!"
"Go away," Melvin said through the door. "I'm not feeling well. Go away."
"It's Stephanie Plum," I said. "I need to talk to you."
The door opened and Melvin looked out. His hair was uncombed and his eyes were bloodshot.
"You were supposed to appear in court this morning," I said.
"I couldn't go. I feel sick."
"You should have called Vinny."
"Oops, I didn't think of that."
I sniffed at his breath.
"Have you been drinking?"
He rocked back on his heels, and a loopy grin spread across his face.
"Nope."
"You smell like cough medicine."
"Cherry schnapps. Someone gave it to me for Christmas."
Oh boy, I couldn't take him in like this. "Melvin, we have to sober you up."
"I'm okay. Except I can't feel my feet."
He looked down.
"I could feel them a minute ago."
I steered him out of the apartment, locked the door behind us, and went down the rickety stairs in front of him to prevent him from breaking his neck. I poured him into my CRV and buckled him in. He hung there suspended by the shoulder harness, mouth open, eyes glazed. I drove him to my parents' house and half-dragged him inside.
"Company, how nice," Grandma Mazur said, helping me haul Melvin into the kitchen.
My mother was ironing and tunelessly singing.
"I've never heard her sing like that," I said to Grandma.
"She's been doing it all day," Grandma said. "I'm starting to get worried, and she's been ironing that same shirt for an hour."
I sat Melvin at the table and gave him some black coffee and made him a ham sandwich.
"Mom," I said, "are you okay?"
"Yes, of course. I'm just ironing, dear."
Melvin rolled his eyes in Grandma's direction.
"Do you know what I did? I urinated on the cake at my ex-wife's wedding. Pissed all over the icing. In front of everyone."
"It could have been worse," Grandma said. "You could have pooped on the dance floor."
"Do you know what happens when you piss on icing? It gets ruined. Makes it all drippy."
"How about the little bride and groom at the top of the cake?" Grandma said. "Did you piss on them too?"
Melvin shook his head.
"I couldn't reach them. I only got the bottom tier."
He put his head down on the table.
"I can't believe I embarrassed myself like that."
"Maybe if you practice, you could get the top tier next time," Grandma said.
"I'm never going to another wedding," Melvin said. "I wish I was dead. Maybe I should just kill myself."
Valerie came into the kitchen carrying a laundry basket.
"What's up?"
"I pissed on the cake," Melvin said. "I was shit-faced."
And then he passed out, face down, in his sandwich.
"I can't take him in like this," I said. He can sleep it off on the couch, my mother said, putting the iron down. Everybody take a body part, and we'll drag him in there.
Ziggy and Benny were in the parking lot when I got home.
We heard you want to make a deal, Ziggy said.
Yep. Do you have Mooner?
Not exactly.
Then it's no deal.
We went all through your apartment and it wasn't there, Ziggy said.
That's because it's someplace else, I told him.
Where?
I'm not telling until I see Mooner.
We could hurt you real bad, Ziggy said. We could make you talk.
My future grandmother-in-law wouldn't like that.
You know what I think, Ziggy said. I think you're fibbing about having it.
I shrugged and turned to go into the building. When you find Mooner, let me know, and we'll deal. Ever since I've had this job, people have been breaking into my apartment. I buy the best locks available, and it doesn't matter. Everyone gets in. The scary part is that I'm starting to get used to it. Not only did Ziggy and Benny leave everything as they found it, they improved on it. They did my dishes and wiped down my counter. The kitchen was nice and tidy. The phone rang, and it was Eddie DeChooch.
I understand you've got it.
Yes.
Is it in good shape?
Yes.
I'm sending someone over to get it.
Hold on, wait a minute. What about Mooner? The deal is that I'm willing to trade Mooner for it. DeChooch made a derisive sound.
Mooner, I don't know why you even care about that loser. Mooner isn't part of the deal. I'll give you money.
I don't want money.
Everyone wants money. Okay, how about this? How about I kidnap you and torture you until you hand it over?
My future grandmother-in-law would put the eye on you.
The old bat is a crackpot. I don't believe in that bunk.
DeChooch hung up. I was getting a lot of fast action on the bait scheme, but I wasn't making any progress getting Mooner back. A big, sad lump was sitting in the middle of my throat. I was scared. No one seemed to have Mooner to trade. I didn't want Mooner or Dougie to be dead. Even worse, I didn't want to be like Valerie, sitting at the table blubbering with her mouth open. Damn! I yelled. Damn, damn, damn! Rex backed out of his soup can and looked up at me, whiskers whirring. I broke off a corner of a strawberry Pop-Tart and handed it to Rex. He shoved the Pop-Tart into his cheek and returned to his can. A hamster of simple pleasures. I called Morelli and asked him over for dinner. Except you have to bring the dinner, I said.
Fried chicken? Meatball sub? Chinese?
Morelli asked.
Chinese.
I rushed into the bathroom, took a shower, shaved my legs so the stupid voice in my head wouldn't screw things up again, and washed my hair with the shampoo that smells like root beer. I rummaged through my lingerie drawer until I found my black lace thong underpants and matching bra. I covered the undies with my usual t-shirt and jeans and swiped on some mascara and lip gloss. If I was going to get kidnapped and tortured, I was going to have some fun first. Bob and Morelli bounded in just as I was pulling on socks.
I've got egg rolls, vegetable stuff, shrimp stuff, pork stuff, rice stuff, and some stuff that I think was supposed to go to somebody else but found its way into my bag, Morelli said. And I got beer.
We put everything on the coffee table and turned the television on. Morelli flipped Bob an egg roll. Bob caught it midair and ate it in one gulp.
We've talked about it, and Bob has agreed to be my best man, Morelli said.
So there's going to be a wedding?
I thought you bought a dress.
I scooped out some shrimp stuff. It's on hold.
What's the problem?
I don't want a big wedding. It feels dopey. But my grandmother and my mother keep dragging me into one. All of a sudden I've got this dress on, and the next thing we've got a hall reserved. It's like someone sucked my mind out of my head.
Maybe we should just go get married.
When?
Can't be tonight. The Rangers are playing. Tomorrow? Wednesday?
Are you serious?
Yeah. Are you going to eat that last egg roll?
My heart stopped dead in my chest. When it started back up again, it was skipping beats. Married. Shit. I was excited, right? That's why I felt like I might throw up. It was the excitement. Don't we need blood tests and licenses and stuff?
Morelli turned his attention to my t-shirt.
Pretty.
The shirt? He traced a line with his fingertip along the lace edge of my bra.
That too.
His hands slid under the cotton fabric, and the shirt was suddenly over my head and discarded.
Maybe you should show me your stuff, he said. Convince me you're worth marrying.
I raised a single eyebrow. Maybe you're the one who should be doing the convincing. Morelli slid the zipper on my jeans.
Cupcake, before the night's over, you're going to be begging me to marry you.
I knew from past experience that this was true. Morelli knew how to make a girl wake up smiling. Tomorrow morning, walking might be difficult, but smiling would be easy. Chapter 9. Morelli's pager went off at 5:30 a.m. Morelli looked at the readout and sighed.
Informer.
I squinted into the darkness as he moved around the room. Do you have to go?
No, I just have to make a phone call.
He walked into the living room. There was a moment of silence, and then he reappeared in the bedroom doorway.
Did you get up in the middle of the night and put the food away?
No.
There's no food on the coffee table.
Bob. I dragged myself out of bed, shoved my arms into my robe, and shuffled out to see the carnage.
I found a couple little wire handles, Morelli said. Looks like Bob ate the food and the cartons.
Bob was pacing at the door. His stomach was distended, and he was drooling.
Perfect.
You make your phone call and I'll walk Bob, I told Morelli. I ran back to the bedroom, pulled on jeans and a sweatshirt, and rammed my feet into boots. I clipped the leash onto Bob and grabbed my car keys.
Car keys?
Morelli asked. In case I need a donut. Donut my foot. Bob was going to do a great big Chinese food poop, and he was going to do it on Joyce's lawn. Maybe I could even get him to hurl. We took the elevator because I didn't want Bob moving around any more than was necessary. We rushed to the car and roared out of the lot. Bob had his nose pressed to the window. He was panting and belching. His stomach was swollen to bursting. I had the gas pedal almost to the floor. Hold on, big fella, I said. We're almost there. Not long now. I screeched to a stop in front of Joyce's house. I ran around to the passenger side, opened the door, and Bob flew out. He rocketed to Joyce's lawn, hunched over, and pooped what appeared to be twice his body weight. He paused for a second and horked up a mixture of cardboard box and shrimp chow mein.
Good boy, I whispered.
Bob gave himself a shake and bolted back to the car. I slammed the door after him, jumped in on my side, and took off before the stench could catch up with us. Another job well done. Morelli was at the coffee maker when I came in.
No donuts?
He asked. I forgot.
I've never known you to forget donuts.
I had other things on my mind.
Like marriage?
That too. Morelli poured out two mugs of coffee and handed one to me.
Ever notice how marriage seems a lot more urgent at night than it does in the morning?
Does that mean you no longer want to get married? Morelli leaned against the counter and sipped his coffee.
You're not getting off the hook that easy.
There are lots of things we've never talked about.
Such as?
Children. Suppose we have children and it turns out we don't like them.
If we can like Bob, we can like anything,
Morelli said. Bob was in the living room, licking lint off the carpet. Eddie DeChooch called 10 minutes after Morelli and Bob left for work.
What's it gonna be?
He asked.
Do you want to make a deal?
I want Mooner.
How many times do I have to tell you? I haven't got him, and I don't know where he is. Nobody I know has him either. Maybe he got scared and ran away.
I didn't know what to say, because it was a possibility.
You're keeping it cold, right? Deschutes said. I need to get it in good shape. My ass is on the line for this.
Yep, it's cold all right. You're not going to believe what good shape it's in. Just find Mooner and you can see for yourself. And I hung up. What the heck was he talking about? I called Connie, but she wasn't in the office yet. I left a message for her to get back to me, and I took a shower. While I was in the shower, I summarized my life. I was after a depressed senior citizen who was making me look like a dunce. Two of my friends were missing without a trace. I looked like I'd just gone around with George Foreman. I had a wedding gown I didn't want to wear and a hall I didn't want to use. Morelli wanted to marry me, and Ranger wanted to... Hell, I didn't want to think about what Ranger wanted to do to me. Oh yeah, and there was Melvin Baylor, who, for all I knew, was still on my parents' couch. I got out of the shower, got dressed, put in minimum effort on my hair, and Connie called. "Have you heard any more from Aunt Flo or Uncle Bingo?" I asked Connie. "I need to know what went wrong in Richmond. I need to know what everyone's looking for. It's something that needs to be kept cold. Pharmaceuticals, maybe."
"How do you know it needs to be kept cold?"
"Deschutes."
"You talk to Deschutes?"
"He calls me. Sometimes I can't believe my own life. I have an FDA who calls me. How weird is that?"
"I'll see what I can find out," Connie said.
I called Grandma next. "I need some information about Eddie Deschutes," I said. "I thought you might ask around."
"What do you want to know?"
"He had a problem in Richmond, and now he's looking for something. I want to know what he's looking for."
"Leave it to me."
"Is Melvin Baylor still there?"
"Nope, he went home."
I said goodbye to Grandma, and there was a knock on my door. I opened the door a crack and looked out. It was Valerie. She was dressed in a tailored black suit jacket and slacks, with a white starched shirt and a man's black and red striped tie. The Meg Ryan shag was plastered back behind her ears. "New look," I said. "What's the occasion?"
"It's my first day as a lesbian."
"Yeah, right."
"I'm serious. I said to myself, why wait? I'm making a fresh start here. I decided I should just jump right in. I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to get a girlfriend. No reason to sit home sulking over a failed relationship."
"I didn't think you were serious the other night. Have you had any, experience as a lesbian?"
"No, but how hard can it be?"
"I don't know if I like this," I said. "I'm used to being the black sheep of the family. This could change my standing."
"Don't be silly," Valerie said. "No one will care that I'm a lesbian."
Valerie was in California way too long.
"Anywho," she said, "I've got a job interview. Do I look okay? I want to be honest about my new sexual orientation, but I don't want to be overly butch."
"You don't want the Dykes on Bikes look."
"Exactly. I want the lesbian chic look."
Having had limited lesbian experience, I wasn't sure what lesbian chic looked like. Mostly I knew television lesbians.
"I'm not certain about the shoes," she said. "Shoes are always so difficult."
She was wearing delicate black patent sandals with a little heel. Her toes were painted bright red. "I guess it depends if you want men's shoes or women's shoes," I said. "Are you a girl lesbian or a boy lesbian?"
"There are two kinds of lesbians?"
"I don't know. Didn't you research this?"
"No, I just assumed lesbians were unisex."
If she was having trouble being a lesbian with her clothes on, I couldn't imagine what was going to happen when she took the clothes off.
"I'm applying for a job at the mall," Valerie said. "And then I have a second job interview downtown. I was wondering if I could swap cars with you. I want to make a good appearance."
"What car are you driving now?"
"Uncle Sandor's 53 Buick."
"Muscle car," I said. "Very lesbian. Much better than my CRV."
"I never thought of that."
I felt a little guilty because the truth is, I didn't know if a 53 Buick would be favored by lesbians. It was just that I really didn't want to swap. I hate the 53 Buick. I waved goodbye and wished her luck as she sashayed down the hall. Rex was out of his can and looking at me.
Either he was thinking I was very clever, or else he was thinking I was a rotten sister. Hard to tell with hamsters. That's why they make such good pets. I slung my black leather bag over my shoulder, grabbed my denim jacket, and locked up. Time to check back on Melvin Baylor. I felt a twinge of nervousness. Eddie DeChooch was worrisome. I didn't like the way he felt comfortable shooting at people on a moment's notice. And now that I was among the threatened, I liked it even less. I crept down the stairs and scurried through the lobby. I looked beyond the glass doors into the lot. No DeChooch anywhere. Mr. Morgenstern stepped out of the elevator.
"Hello, cutie," Mr. Morgenstern said. "Whoa, looks like you ran into a doorknob."
"All part of the job," I said to Mr. Morgenstern. Mr. Morgenstern was very old, possibly 200.
"I saw your young friend leaving yesterday. He might be a little funny in the head, but he travels in style. You've got to like a man who travels in style,"
Mr. Morgenstern said. "What young friend?"
"The Mooner person. The one who wears the Superman suit and his long brown hair."
My heart skipped a beat. It never occurred to me that any of my neighbors would have information about Mooner. "When did you see him? What time?"
"It was early in the morning. The bakery down the street opens at 6, and I walked there and back, so I guess I saw your friend around 7 o'clock. He came out of the door just as I was going in. He was with a lady, and they both got into a big black limousine. I never rode in a limousine. Must be something."
"Did he say anything to you?"
"He said, 'Dude.'"
"Did he look okay? Did he look worried?"
"Nope. He looked same as always. You know, like nobody's home."
"What did the woman look like?"
"Nice-looking woman. Short, sort of brown hair. Young."
"How young?"
"About 60, maybe."
"I don't suppose the limo had anything written on it, like the name of the limo company?"
"Not that I recall. It was just a big black limo."
I turned on my heel, went back upstairs, and started calling limo companies. It took me a half hour to go through all the listings in the phone book. Only two companies made pickups that early yesterday morning. Both pickups were town cars, and they both were making airport runs. Neither was booked by or picked up a woman. Dead end again. I drove over to Melvin's apartment and knocked on his door. Melvin answered with a bag of frozen corn on his head.
"I'm dying," he said. "My head's exploding. My eyes are on fire."
He looked awful. Worse than yesterday, and that was going some. "I'll be back later," I told him. "Don't do any more drinking, okay?" 5 minutes later, I was at the office.
"Hey," Lula said, "look at this. Your eyes are sort of black and green today. That's a good sign."
"Has Joyce been in yet?"
"She came in about 15 minutes ago," Connie said. "She was nuts, raving about shrimp chow mein."
"She was gonzo," Lula said. "Made no sense at all. Never seen her so mad. I don't suppose you know anything about the shrimp."
"Nope, not me."
"How's Bob? He know anything about the chow mein?"
"Bob's fine. He had a stomach problem earlier this morning, but he's okay now." Connie and Lula did a high five.
"I knew it," Lula said.
"I'm driving around checking out a few houses," I said. "I was wondering if anyone wanted to go with me."
"Uh-oh," Lula said. "The only time you want company is when you're worried someone's out to get you."
"Eddie DeChooch might sort of be looking for me." Probably other people were after me, too. But Eddie DeChooch seemed the craziest and most likely to shoot me, although the old lady with the scary eyes was starting to run a close second.
"I guess we can handle Eddie DeChooch," Lula said, getting her handbag out of the bottom file drawer. "He's just a little bitty depressed old man."
With a gun. Lula and I dropped in on Mooner's roommates first. "Is Mooner here?" I asked.
"Nope, haven't seen him. He might be at Dougie's. He's there a lot."
We went to Dougie's house next. I took Dougie's keys when Mooner got shot, and I'd never given them back. I opened the front door, and Lula and I did a walkthrough. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary.
I went back to the kitchen and looked in the freezer and refrigerator.
What's that about?
Lula asked. Just checking. After Dougie's house, we drove to Eddie DeChooch's house. The crime scene tape was gone, and the DeChooch half looked dark and unlived in. I parked the car, and Lula and I did a walkthrough in DeChooch's house. Again, nothing out of the ordinary. Just for the hell of it, I looked in the freezer and refrigerator. There was a pot roast in the freezer.
I could see that pot roast turns you on, Lula said.
Dougie had a pot roast stolen from his freezer.
Uh-huh.
This could be it. This could be the stolen pot roast.
Let me get this straight. You think Eddie DeChooch broke into Dougie's house and stole a pot roast?
Now that I heard it said out loud, it sounded kind of dumb. It could happen, I said. We drove by the social club and the church, cruised through Mary Maggie's parking garage, cut over to Ace Paver's, and ended with Ronald DeChooch's house in North Trenton. In the course of our travels, we covered most of Trenton and all of the burg.
That's it for me, Lula said. I need fried chicken. I want some of that cluck in a bucket extra spicy, extra greasy. And I want biscuits and coleslaw and one of them shakes that are so thick you gotta suck your guts out to get it up a straw.
Cluck in a bucket is just a couple blocks from the office. It has a big revolving chicken impaled on a pole that sprouts out of the McAdam parking lot, and it has excellent fast food fried chicken.